We're going to be looking at Deuteronomy chapter 32 tonight. And it's going to be quite a long reading. And at first glance, when you read Deuteronomy chapter 32, it might not seem like this, but it's actually one of the most significant chapters in the Bible. Let me just remind you what the situation is when Moses speaks these words. The people of Israel have been wandering through the wilderness for 40 years. You'll remember that they originally reached the edge of Canaan and they refused to go in. And then God said, since you've refused to go in, you'll have to wander through the wilderness for 40 years until all the adults over the age of 20 had died. And now those 40 years are over and they're back on the edge of Canaan, the promised land. And Moses is about to die. He's not going to enter the promised land with them. And the book of Deuteronomy is Moses' final words to the nation of Israel. And he goes through everything that's happened. He reminds them of the history, how it is that they are here standing on the edge of the promised land. And he reminds them of the covenant that they made with God at Sinai. He reminds them of all those laws that they've promised to keep. And he reminds them, he tells them of the great blessings that they'll be if they keep those commands. And he warns them of the terrible curses that will come across them, come on them, if they disobey that covenant. And throughout the book of Deuteronomy, Moses again and again has urged them to keep God's commands, to follow God with their whole hearts. But then, after Moses has said all that, God gives him these words to say to the people. And we're just going to read a few verses from the previous chapter, Deuteronomy 31, so that we can understand why these words are here, why this song is here. You'll see it's a song. So we'll read from verse 19. So God says this to Moses, "Now therefore write this song and teach it to the people of Israel. Put it in their mouths that this song may be a witness for me against the people of Israel. For when I have brought them into the land flowing with milk and honey, which I swore to give to their fathers, and they have eaten and are full and grown fat, they will turn to other gods and serve them, and despise me and break my covenant. And when many evils and troubles have come upon them, this song shall confront them as a witness, for it will live unforgotten in the mouths of their offspring. For I know what they are inclined to do even today, before I have brought them into the land that I swore to give." So Moses wrote this song the same day and taught it to the people of Israel. So the words we're going to read tonight, this song that we find in Deuteronomy 32, predicts the future. It says what's going to happen. Moses is to teach the song to the Israelites. They're to learn it. They're to learn it off by heart and teach it to their children. And then it's going to act as a witness against them in the years to come. The fact is that Israel, you'll see from the song, are going to rebel against God. They are going to turn against him and serve other gods. And is it something that they do in ignorance? No, it's not, because God has told them in advance that they're going to do it. Israel are going to be like lemmings who know that the cliff is coming and still go ahead and jump over the cliff. The tragedy of Israel's rebellion against God is that it was all written down in advance. And that's why this song becomes so significant, because the later Bible writers are going to refer to it again and again to explain what's happening to the nation, to show how their actions, their sin and rebellion is inevitable. And there's also going to be one day far in the future where that cycle of sin and rebellion will be broken. Maybe one day we'll go through the whole of Deuteronomy 32 and see how that works out. But that's certainly not what we're going to do tonight. And we'll only have time to look at a few points from this chapter tonight. But we will read most of the chapter. So we'll just start one verse before in Deuteronomy 31, verse 30. Which says this. Then Moses spoke the words of this song until they were finished in the ears of all the assembly of Israel. Give ear, O heavens, and I will speak, and let the earth hear the words of my mouth. May my teaching drop as the rain, my speech distill as the dew, like gentle rain upon the tender grass, and like showers upon the herb. For I will proclaim the name of the Lord, ascribe greatness to our God, the rock. His work is perfect, for all his ways are justice. A God of faithfulness and without iniquity, just and upright is he. They have dealt corruptly with him. They are no longer his children because they are blemished. They are a crooked and twisted generation. Do you thus repay the Lord, you foolish and senseless people? Is not he your father who created you, who made you and established you? Remember the days of old. Consider the years of many generations. Ask your father, and he will tell you. Your elders, and they will tell you. When the Most High gave to the nations their inheritance, when he divided mankind, he fixed the borders of the peoples according to the number of the sons of God. But the Lord's portion is his people, Jacob, his allotted heritage. He found him in a desert land, and in the howling waste of the wilderness. He encircled him. He cared for him. He kept him as the apple of his eye. Like an eagle that stirs up its nest, that flutters over its young, spreading out its wings, catching them, bearing them on its pinions, the Lord alone guided him. No foreign god was with him. He made him ride on the high places of the land, and he ate the produce of the field, and he suckled him with honey out of the rock and oil out of the flinty rock, curds from the herd and milk from the flock, with fat of lambs, rams of Bashan and goats, with the very finest of the wheat, and you drank foaming wine made from the blood of the grape. But Jeshurun grew fat and kicked. You grew fat, stout, and sleek. Then he forsook God who made him, and scoffed at the rock of his salvation. They stirred him to jealousy with strange gods. With abominations they provoked him to anger. They sacrificed to demons that were no gods, to gods they had never known, to new gods that had come recently, whom your fathers had never dreaded. You were unmindful of the rock that bore you, and you forgot the God who gave you birth. The Lord saw it and spurned them because of the provocation of his sons and daughters. And he said, I will hide my face from them. I will see what their end will be. For they are a perverse generation, children in whom is no faithfulness. They have made me jealous with what is no God. They have provoked me to anger with their idols. So I will make them jealous with those who are no people. I will provoke them to anger with a foolish nation. For a fire is kindled in my anger, and it burns to the depths of Sheol, devours the earth and its increase, and sets on fire the foundations of the mountains. And I will heap disasters upon them. I will expend my arrows on them. They shall be wasted with hunger and devoured by plague and poisonous pestilence. I will send the teeth of beasts against them, with the venom of things that crawl in the dust. Outdoors the sword shall bereave, and indoors terror, for young man and woman alike, the nursing child with the man of grey hairs. I would have said, I will cut them to pieces, I will wipe them from human memory, had I not feared provocation by the enemy, lest their adversaries should misunderstand, lest they should say, our hand is triumphant, it was not the Lord who did this. For they are a nation void of counsel, and there is no understanding in them. If they were wise, they would understand this. They would discern their latter end. How could one have chased 1,000 and two have put 10,000 to flight, unless their rock had sold them and the Lord had given them up? For their rock is not as our rock. Our enemies are by themselves. For their vine comes from the vine of Sodom and from the fields of Gomorrah. Their grapes are grapes of poison, their clusters are bitter. Their wine is the poison of serpents and the cruel venom of asps. Is this not laid up in store with me, sealed up in my treasuries? Vengeance is mine and recompense for the time when their foot shall slip. For the day of their calamity is at hand, and their doom comes swiftly. For the Lord will vindicate his people and have compassion on his servants, when he sees that their power is gone and there is none remaining, bond and free or free. Then he will say, where are their gods, the rock in which they took refuge, who ate the fat of their sacrifices and drank the wine of their drink offering? Let them rise up and help you. Let them be your protection. See now that I, even I, am he, and there is no God beside me. I kill and I make alive. I wound and I heal, and there is none that can deliver out of my hand. For I lift up my hand to heaven and swear, as I live forever, if I sharpen my flashing sword and my hand takes hold on judgment, I will take vengeance on my adversaries and will repay those who hate me. I will make my arrows drunk with blood, and my sword shall devour flesh with the blood of the slain and the captives from the long-haired heads of the enemy. Rejoice with him, O heavens! Bow down to him, all gods, for he avenges the blood of his children. He takes vengeance on his adversaries. He repays those who hate him and cleanses his people's land. Moses came and recited all the words of this song in the hearing of the people, he and Joshua, son of Nun. And when Moses had finished speaking all these words to all Israel, he said to them, take to heart all these words by which I am warning you today, that you may command them to your children, that they may be careful to do all the words of this law. For it is no empty word for you, but your very life. And by this word you shall live long in the land that you are going over the Jordan to possess. Like I said, it's a long passage, and we're not going to have time to look at all of it by any means. But we spent the last couple of weeks looking at some of the background for calling God the rock. So we looked at the accounts where Moses strikes a rock with his staff, with the staff of God, and water flows from that rock. And then last week we thought about the way that picture of water flowing in dry desert places is used throughout the Bible as a picture of God's own presence flowing as a blessing into the lives of his people. Well, tonight we're actually going to look at a passage where God is directly called the rock. And the first time that happens in the Bible is here in Deuteronomy chapter 32. So let's see what it says. So Moses begins in verse 1 by calling on the heavens and the earth to hear his words. He says, "Give ear, O heavens, and I will speak, and let the earth hear the words of my mouth." So remember what this song is. It's a song of witness against Israel. So the heavens and the earth are being called to be witnesses, to listen to the song. On the day of judgment, the very heavens and the earth are going to stand up and condemn this nation because they've heard these words spoken. Moses' words, yes, but God's words. And that makes all these words deeply solemn, doesn't it? The fact that the heavens and the earth have been summoned to hear them. And yet, although these words are words of condemnation, they aren't only words of condemnation. Moses actually starts here with a wonderful proclamation. Verse 3, he says, "For I will proclaim the name of the Lord," the name of Yahweh. He's going to start by telling the Israelites and by telling us what God is like. And the proclamation is going to be a delightful proclamation. Do you see what he says about his words? He says, "May my teaching drop as the rain, my speech distill as the dew." Moses' words are going to be like gentle showers of rain falling down on green grass. They're going to be words of delight and refreshment. Now remember that the people he's speaking to have been wandering around in a dry wilderness for 40 years. They won't have seen rain very often. The Sinai Peninsula is a very, very dry place. And every time they did see rain, it would have been wonderful. I know here, living in Stockport in England, rain might not seem much of a blessing. But for desert nomads, wandering in the wilderness, rain was almost the greatest blessing of all. And rain on grass would have been an even greater blessing. And it's actually something they've been promised in the promised land. That's one of the wonderful things. This is what it says in Deuteronomy chapter 11. "The land you're entering to take possession of is not like the land of Egypt from which you've come, where you sowed your seed and irrigated it like a garden of vegetables." So in Egypt, there was plenty of water from the Nile, but you had to dig ditches to get the water to where you were growing vegetables. "But the land that you are going over to possess is a land of hills and valleys, which drinks water by the rain from heaven, a land the Lord your God cares for. The eyes of the Lord your God are always upon it, from the beginning of the year to the end of the year." So the idea of rain falling and the land drinking up that rain is just a wonderful thought. And that's what Moses' words here are like. They're refreshing words. Perhaps we should be more grateful for our green, water-soaked land. It is a great blessing from God. So what is God like? What are these wonderful, refreshing words that Moses is going to say? And he tells us in verse 4. He tells us that God is the rock. The rock. His work is perfect. Now, Israel might not have seen much rain in their wilderness wanderings, but they sure had seen a lot of rocks. It's that wilderness was a very rocky place. It was something they're very familiar with. So Moses is using something that they've seen day by day. Everyone knows what rocks are like. All of us know what rocks are like, aren't we? We know that they're hard. We know what they feel like. We've seen huge mountains, we've seen rocky outcrops, we've seen small rocks. We all know how they feel. We all know how solid they are. We all know how much it hurts when you stub your toe on a rock. So Moses is using a picture that's easy to understand. But what does he actually mean? Yeah, it's a picture we can understand, but what does it mean that God is the rock? And I'm going to draw out tonight three different aspects of God's character which Moses describes using this picture of the rock. And the first is this. The first characteristic of God which makes him the rock is that he's incorruptibly righteous and just. And that's what we see in verse 4. The rock, his work is perfect. For all his ways are justice, a God of faithfulness, and without iniquity, just and upright is he. And the point is that a rock is something that doesn't change. You can't take a piece of granite and bend it into a different shape. You can't bang it and make it into a different shape. It just stays the same. If I go out for a walk in the Peak District and I see a great craggy boulder, then I know I'm seeing the same shape of boulder that a man who walked there 100 years ago saw. God, we're told, is perfect. He's just. He's upright. He's faithful. He's without iniquity. And none of those characteristics of God can be changed. You can take a rock and you can kick it, or you can hit it, and it doesn't do anything, does it? You might hurt yourself, but you don't harm the rock. It stays the same. And we live in a world, don't we, that's very changeable. Our own lives are always changing. Our jobs change. Our health changes. The technology we use is always changing. Even the way that we look over time changes. I've got more grey hairs now than I used to. The places where people live, all those things change, but the mountains stay the same, don't they? If you go and look at Everest or Mont Blanc, it still looks the same shape as it has done for our whole lives. That's something that stays solidly the same. And that's what God's like. He's unchangeably just. He's unchangeably upright. And that is such good news for us, because that makes God completely and utterly trustworthy. Makes him completely reliable. You know, when you rest your back against a great rock, you know that it's not going to fall over, don't you? You know that you're safe to lean back. It's going to carry your weight. You can trust your weight to it. Well, that's God. We can safely lean on him. If God makes a promise to us, then we know that that promise will stand. He's faithful. He's not going to change. Nobody can stop him from keeping those promises. Nothing can stop him from keeping his promises. When God makes laws, they're unchangeable. He doesn't change them. And that's so important, because we live in a world where right and wrong is treated as something which changes, doesn't it? Depending on the civilization or society we live in. Things that people thought of as wrong 40 years ago are now thought of as okay today. But it's God's character which defines right and wrong. And so what was wrong at Sinai is wrong today. We can be sure that right and wrong, good and bad, are mountains. They're solid rock. They're absolutes, because they're part of God's character. And the truths that people found out about God in the past. You know, when Abraham and Moses and David encountered God and they found out what his character was like, well, those things are just as true today. We can take the words that Moses or David wrote about God, and we can say he's unchanging. They're still true today. That means the Bible is still useful to us. Let's face it, if God changed every 100 years, this would be useless, wouldn't it? We could just throw it out the window because it wouldn't mean the same thing anymore. So God's rock-likeness means that he's absolutely trustworthy, and we can rest our whole weight on him. And Moses pulls that out by a comparison with the Israelites. They are so different to him. Do you remember what these Israelites have done? They've promised absolute loyalty to God. They've promised him that they will keep all his commands. And children, they've become his children. That's the words that are used. That Israel have become God's children. You expect children to be like their parents, don't you? Children look like their parents, and they pick up the same belief systems and behaviour systems, and you see the same characteristics. You see the similarity between children and parents. And so what are Israel meant to be like? Well, they're meant to be rock-like, aren't they? They're meant to be faithful, and they're meant to be just in the way they deal with people. They're meant to be upright. They're meant to be without iniquity. And they're supposed to be like that for their whole lives. And Moses says, they have dealt corruptly with him. They are no longer his children because they're blemished. They're a crooked and twisted generation. They're everything that a lump of rock isn't. That's exactly, you can't twist rock out of shape. It can't become corrupt. It's just rock, isn't it? It just stays the same. But these people, the Israelites, have changed. They do change. They're meant to be faithful to God. They're meant to have nothing to do with the gods of the Canaanites. They're not supposed to look at the nations around them and copy their behaviour. They're supposed to be faithful to God. But they're corrupted. They change. And that's what human beings are like, isn't it? That's the unregenerate human heart. It's not rock-like at all. It's not faithful. It's not just. It just changes. It's like jelly. We just do whatever's convenient, whatever suits, whatever won't get us into trouble, whatever we want. Here's God, the rock. And here's who are meant to be his rock-like people, and they're just twisted, corrupted jelly. Well, what about us? Christians, God's people today. We're called God's children, aren't we? We serve the same incorruptible, righteous God. And that means if we're his children, that we should be rock-like, shouldn't we? We're meant to be rock-like in justice and goodness and faithfulness. We're meant to be people who are determined to obey him in everything. We should refuse to compromise with evil. We should be people striving for perfection. But of course, we were born with the same kind of evil, corrupt, twisted, jelly-like hearts as these Israelites. So is it possible that we can succeed where they failed? Is it possible for jelly blobs to become buttresses of stone? This is what Paul says. This is Philippians and chapter 2, verse 14. And Paul says, yes, it is possible. He says this. He says, do all things without grumbling or disputing, that you may be blameless and innocent, children of God, without blemish, in the midst of a crooked and twisted generation, among whom you shine as lights in the world, holding fast to the word of life, so that in the day of Christ I may be proud that I did not run in vain or labour in vain. So Paul is prepared to look at the people in Philippi, the Gentiles living in Philippi, and say, and use this language. He says, you live in a crooked and twisted generation. And he looks at the Christians in the church in Philippi, and he says, but you're not like that. You are God's children. The Israelites were no longer God's children, but the Philippians are God's children, and they shine as lights because they're different. The fact is that when Christ the Rock sends his Spirit to dwell in our hearts, then we are able to obey and serve him. So we can and we must become rocks of righteousness and faithfulness. That's our privilege as believers. I'm not saying that we do it perfectly, but Paul says, you shine as lights in this world. So that's the first characteristic of God. He's unchangeably faithful and just, incorruptible. The second characteristic of God as the rock is an unexpected one. And it's that he's the source of all blessing and goodness. And you see that between verses 10 and 18. I won't read them all. But in those verses, you see Moses describing how God cared for the Israelites in the wilderness, how he found him in a desert land, how he guarded over him. Watched over him, brought him safely through the wilderness. And then how God brings Israel into the promised land and provides for all those needs. You might think it's a bit odd, remembering when Moses says this, it's before they've entered the promised land, yeah? And yet Moses speaks of this all in the past tense. He says, he made him ride on the high places of the land. He ate the produce of the field. And you might say to yourself, well, hang on, they're not there yet. Why does Moses speak in that way? It's because this is absolutely guaranteed to happen. Moses can speak of it as already happening, having happened, because it's so sure. There's no doubts that it's going to happen. This is something that God is certainly going to do. It's something you find in other places in the Old Testament. Something is spoken of has already happened, which is a future event, because it's absolutely certain. And you see as you read these verses the blessings that God is going to give to these people. Canaan, that land they were going to, was a fertile land. We already read about the rain that fell on it. It's always described to the people as a land flowing with milk and honey. It was a place where you could have flocks. It was a place where honeybees nested in all sorts of places. You remember Samson finds bees in the carcass of a lion, and how Jonathan finds honey just on the forest floor and picks it up with his staff and eats some. That's the kind of land Israel was. There's going to be rams and lambs and goats and wheat and foaming wine. Those are the blessings that the people are going to enjoy in Canaan. But it's slightly strange, because Moses says in verse 13 that God suckled him with honey out of the rock and oil out of the flinty rock. And when you read that, you think that's a bit funny, isn't it? Because bees don't usually nest in rocks. You don't normally get honey from rocks. And you don't get oil, and the oil that he'll be talking about would be olive oil. Well, olive oil doesn't flow out of rocks. You don't squeeze a rock and get oil, do you? But remember who's speaking. It's Moses. And remember who he's speaking to. He's speaking to the people of Israel. And these are people who have seen rocks split open and water flow out. When they hear Moses saying that blessings like honey and oil are going to flow out from the rocks, well, they're meant to understand who it's coming from. Moses is telling them that those blessings are coming from God. And not just those, but all the other ones he describes. Curds and milk and lambs. These are all blessings, prosperity that's flowing from God. God is the source of every goodness. That's part of what it means for him to be the rock of their salvation. He's the one from whom prosperity flows, even from unlikely situations. Israel is meant to be a people living in constant thankfulness to God. They're meant to be always praising him and thanking him. And yet, what's going to happen? Verse 15, but Jeshurun, that's just another name being used for Israel here, grew fat and kicked. You grew fat, stout and sleek. Then he forsook God who made him and scoffed at the rock of his salvation. They stirred him to jealousy with strange gods. With abominations they provoked him to anger. They sacrificed to demons that were no gods, to gods they had never known, to new gods that had come recently, whom your fathers had never dreaded. You are unmindful of the rock that bore you. You forgot the God who gave them birth. Here in this song of witness, Moses lays down, first of all, that these people should be so full of gratefulness towards God. He's the rock of their salvation, the one who's poured out all this blessing on them. And yet they're going to quickly forget about him and turn to other gods. They're abandoning the rock who bore them. This song is a witness of, it's horrible, isn't it? The ungratefulness of these people. Their wickedness is appalling. And it's all written down here in advance. Well, that was the Israelites. We've said it before, but let's say it again. We shouldn't be like the Israelites. We shouldn't fall into this trap of being ungrateful and forgetful. We're meant to be a people who are marked by thankfulness and praise towards God. Think about just the blessings that God has poured out on us. He's poured out physical blessings on us, hasn't he? And we have homes, families, food and drink, work and health. We have beauty, music. We have a world of interest and variety. We just have so many physical blessings. We have more physical blessings than the Israelites had living in Britain in the 21st century. But then he's given us far more than that. He's given us spiritual blessings. As God's people, as Christians, we've been given forgiveness of sin. We've been given God's mercy and grace. We've been given the Lord Jesus himself. We've been given friendship with God. We've been given a place in his family. We've been promised heaven and the world to come. We're given protection and guidance and God's word. The spiritual blessings that we enjoy are far greater than any spiritual blessings that Israel had. So we've got to be people who live remembering that God is the source of all our blessing. We must be people who live lives of praise and thanksgiving. We've got to be people who give thanks to the Lord, for he is good. His love endures forever. We've got to be people who, as James says, give thanks to God because every good gift and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow due to change. The unchanging God is the one who's still pouring out every good gift, every perfect gift. All our blessings are flowing from him. So as well as being rock-like people in our characters, reflecting God's unchanging justice, we must be grateful people. We must be people who are constantly giving thanks to God, praising him, that he's the source of all goodness, of all blessing. He's the rock in that sense as well. And then the third characteristic of God that makes him rock-like is the fact that he is a place of refuge. And I'm not going to say lots in detail about this tonight, because it's actually going to be our main subject next time. God as the rock of refuge is one of the themes that David comes back to again and again in the Psalms. And that's what we'll be looking at next time. We'll be looking at some of those Psalms. So we're going to think about this in real detail next time. But just briefly, we'll glance at what Moses says about this. And the main thing is just to see that that a rock can be a place of safety, protection from danger. That was something that Moses himself had experienced. The danger, the surprising danger in a way that Moses encountered, was God's own presence. This is what it says in Exodus chapter 33, verse 21. God says this to Moses: "Behold, there is a place by me where you shall stand on the rock, and while my glory passes by, I will put you in a cleft of the rock, and I will cover you with my hand until I have passed by." So Moses himself has known the experience of being hidden in a cleft of the rock, because it was too dangerous for him to see God's face. That's the God's presence, isn't it? Is the greatest danger of all. And Moses knows that that rock on that occasion protected him. And so it's very natural for him to take up this picture of God as a rock of refuge. And if you look at this chapter, at the song from verse 19 on, we're told about how God reacts to the unfaithfulness, to the wickedness of his people. We're told about the appalling disasters that he sends against them. And one of them is that they're going to be attacked by vicious enemies. It's going to be such that one person is going to be able to put 1,000 Israelites to flight. Two people, 10,000. They're going to come to fight against their enemies, and they're going to flee away in all directions. The Israelites are going to be persecuted by enemies. And why does God send that punishment on the nation? Well, the reason is because instead of trusting in God to protect them, instead of trusting on the Lord, they've gone and put their trust in other gods, into false gods, the gods of those other nations. So verse 37. "Then he will say," and then the Lord will say to them, "Where are their gods? The rock in which they took refuge, who ate the fat of their sacrifices and drank the wine of their drink offering. Let them rise up and help you. Let them be your protection." God says to the people, okay, if you want to trust in the gods of the nations, do it. See how it helps you. Use them as your rock of refuge, your protection. But of course it doesn't work, does it? They're attacked by vicious enemies, and they find they have no protection at all. The people, the Israelites, have to learn that if they won't trust God, they can't have his protection. He's going to withdraw himself from them. Verse 29. "If they were wise, they would understand this. They would discern their latter end. How could one have chased 1,000 and two put 10,000 to flight unless their rock had sold them and the Lord had given them up. God has sold this people. He's given up on them. He's not protecting them. For their rock is not as our rock. Our enemies are by themselves. Moses is saying, this rock that they've trusted in, these false gods, is not like our rock, the true God, the Lord. Our enemies are actually by themselves. They don't actually have anyone to help them at all, because those false gods are just made up. It's only when the Israelites have learnt that that God will rescue them. Verse 36, for the Lord will vindicate his people and have compassion on his servants when he sees their power is gone, that there is none remaining, bond or free. And that was a horribly painful lesson that Israel had to learn through history. When they forgot Yahweh, when they turned against him to other gods, it led them to defeat and disaster and to exile and poverty. At the times when they cried out to him and they put their trust in him as the rock, then they found deliverance and peace and victory. And in the end, they rejected God. And it led to the end of them as the nation and the end of the covenant. That was the painful lesson that Israel had to learn. So let's not make the same mistake as the Israelites. It's very tempting for us, I think, to not put our trust in God. There's so many things that we can trust in: our family, our friends, the money that we've got in the bank, and our families. It's very easy for us to take our eyes off God and trust to those things instead. But we need to look at God. Look at God as we thought about him tonight. He's unchangeably just and righteous. He's unshakably faithful. He's an unmovable rock in that way. And he's the eternal source of every blessing and every good. Why would we look anywhere else? He's the only place of safety and protection. Other things might appear to offer protection, but in the end, if you trust those things, you'll find that you're by yourself. They're not real, they evaporate away. God is solid, unchanging, safe, place to be protected. We need to be people who are trusting God for everything, in every way. So that's God as a rock. He's the unchanging rock in his character. He's the eternal source of every blessing and every good. And he's the rock of refuge. He's the God that we can trust for everything.